Okay. We're going to look at the a couple of letters of Maimonides. Obviously, Maimonides wrote many, many letters. He wrote over 400 letters that we know about, that we have in our possession. There are numerous collections of the letters of Maimonides. You could really divide them into three major categories. There are letters which are written to entire communities. Those are some of the most famous. For example, he wrote after the community, Jewish community in Yemen, had experienced particularly horrific, I suppose you could call it an inquisition, shmud, by the Muslims there. Many Jews had suffered martyrdom, many had converted to Islam, and it was a terrible situation. It was in the aftermath of this inquisition that Maimonides wrote his most famous letter, which is called Igeres Teiman, the letter to Yemen, in which he writes encouragement to the Jews of Yemen. He talks about the fact that this type of stuff is not unexpected. He says, we have been told in the Torah that people will be trying to fight against us in many different ways, whether by the sword or through the tongue. Right, Cole, and he says we have been guaranteed that every sword that rises against us will not succeed, and every tongue that tries to show our falsehood will itself be found to be false. And he says, in addition, we have been warned by the Torah, there are those who will try to destroy us through imitation. They'll try to set up Bnei Peritzei Amcha Yinasu Lahamid Chazon V'loyatzlichu. They will attempt to raise up an image of what you've got of Torah, which of course has happened in many religions, and they will not succeed. He writes beautiful words of encouragement to the Yemenite Jews. Another one of these famous letters is Igeres Kiddush Hashem, the letter of Kiddush Hashem, sanctification of God's name, in which he delineates precisely how one should act in a situation where one is threatened by death, rather than changing your religion, and what are the laws regarding Islam, which has one law, and Christianity, which would have quite a different way of relating to it, for the simple reason that Islam is monotheistic, whereas Christianity is polytheistic in that sense, incarnation and the Trinity, etc. So that's one category of letters, the famous letters he sent to communities. Then we have the section that I would call Tshuvot, answers to halachic questions. Like many of the great rabbis throughout the generations, people sent them questions. For those who don't have copies of the letters, there is a stack on the chair at the back, and there's a stack over here as well. In any case, answers to halachic questions, shaylos and tshuvos. One example, which is actually, there's quite a few which are actually cited in the Code of Jewish Law. One of them, for example, someone asked him, he said he found a very particularly beautiful poem, a piyut, liturgical poem, written by one of the Geonim, one of the great sages of previous times, and it spoke of sin, an atonement from sin. It spoke of how terrible Golos is, exile is, and the depth of exile, etc. And this man wanted to incorporate it into the Shabbos prayers. Maimonides writes, he says, Shabbos, he says, is a day which is called a delight and an honor and an enjoyment. It is the day that our prophets told us, right, that we should delight in Hashem. It's the day in which the sages cut out many, many of our regular prayers, so we shouldn't be depressed. We should be happy. We should be in a good frame of mind, he says, and you want to sing a poem, as beautiful as it may be, that is the exact antithesis of all of this. He says, you know what? He says, it's up to you. He says, this is what I have said. You choose, not me. And clearly, I'm sure any person who would read that responsa would surely choose not to say that, because he says it's depressing. Another example, someone asked him, he wanted to embroider on his talus verses from the Torah. He wanted to embroider verses from the Torah on his talus in the same style as they are written in the Torah itself. The same font, the Kitav HaSharit, he wanted to embroider on his talus. The Rambam offers, if I remember correctly, five reasons that it's prohibited. He says, a talus can be worn into a bathroom. He says, but you cannot take a verse from the Torah into the bathroom. He says, so putting a verse of the Torah on something which you normally would wear into the bathroom is putting in a situation which will denigrate it, which will, like it's like having on your t-shirt sukkim from the Torah, which you cannot do. So that's number one. He said, number two, he says that any time you write a sentence from the Torah, it requires sirtut, it requires that it be written in a very specific way with lines under, engraved underneath it, so it should be straight. You're not going to be able to do that in embroidery, so he says it's prohibited for that reason. He says, number three, davar chadash hu lo ra'inu me'olam. It's new. We've never seen anyone do this. That alone, he says, consider a reason not to do it. Right? He says, you ever saw your grandfather do this? No. He says, can't do it. And he also says that there's a custom, ancient custom, where you cannot use the writing style of the Torah scroll for anything but Torah, tefillin, and mezuzah. He says the writing style of the Torah is sacred, can only be used for things which are sacred. And the Rambam adds, that's why, he says, if you look at ancient coins and inscriptions from archaeology of the Jewish people in ancient times, you'll almost never find anything in the writing style of the Torah. He says, because the simple reason is that Jews did not use it. And even today, and by the way, the Rav Moshe Isserles quotes this tshuva of the Rambam in the Laws of Sefer Torah to say that you cannot use Ksav Ashuris for anything but Torah, Tefillin, and Mezuzah. He, by the way, does not list Bar Mitzvah invitations as an exception to that rule. I know this is a shock, but he doesn't talk about Sidurim. He says only Torah, Tefillin, Mezuzah. That's what the Rambam says. That's what I know, that the Mekubalim, Kabbalists, have the idea of, Nefesh HaChaim says this, to imagine the letters in your mind when you are davening, and ideally one should imagine the letters as they're written in the Torah scroll, and there were some Sidurim printed in Ktav Asherit for that specific reason, so you can imagine the letters in their original style of the Torah scroll. I'm not so sure if Maimonides would be happy with that. He might say, "Ei davar chadash lo ra'inu me'olam." It's new; we've never seen it before. And he might also say that it's not Torah, Tefillin, Mezuzah. So I'm not so sure. But again, and by the way, that little point that he adds will solve a problem that archaeologists raise, which is the absence of this text from ancient inscriptions. Of course, if you know anything about Jewish law and custom, it's not a problem. The absence of the text is because the Jewish people were keeping this ancient custom. Right? Some archaeologists say, the absence of the text means it never existed in ancient times, which of course is ludicrous when you read the Rambam. So he's got a whole lot of tshuvot, responsa literature. And then the third section are letters to individuals, and that could be subdivided into a number of sections. He's got some letters which are of a personal nature. Some letters are of a very personal nature. He has a letter to his one of his students, who also translated many of the works of Maimonides, because as you probably know, most of the works of Maimonides are written in Arabic and translated into Hebrew later. One of the great translators of Maimonides was Yehuda Ibn Tibbon, who lived in southern France. And Ibn Tibbon writes to Maimonides he'd like to come and visit him and discuss with him his translations. The Rambam writes back, he says, "I love you like my own son." He says, "I would like nothing better than to talk to you, to see your face, and to have the opportunity to discuss the translation." He says, "But let me tell you a little bit about my day. I wake up before dawn and pray. He says, I then make a long journey from Fostat, which is old Cairo, to the court of the Sultan Salah al-Din, otherwise known as Saladin. He says, where I attend to his court, to his court, to the harem, I'm the doctor of the entire court of Saladin. He says, that takes me until early evening. I then take a long ride back to my house where I pray quickly, grab something to eat. Already standing outside my house, there are people waiting to see me. I'm a physician, he says. People are waiting to see me as a doctor. He says, I go through the line of patients, and I see who's most urgently in need of care. I ask each person apologies and tell them that I guess I'll have to wait. And he says, I then go, Jews and Gentiles alike standing there, I then go into my surgery, I see patients. He says, by close to midnight, I'm too tired to stand up. I lie down on the bed and I examine the patients while I'm lying down because I have no strength to stand up. He says, when I finish with the last patients, it's close to midnight, I'm able to grab something else to eat, and then I can start learning Torah and working on my books. He says, the journey from France is long and arduous. He says, it's dangerous as well. He says, for you to be able to come and see me and risk your life on a journey like that is for maybe 3 minutes. He says, when it comes to Shabbat, on Shabbat, he says, again, after prayers, people come from communities all over the Jewish world for the specific purpose of consulting with the Rambam on Shabbat. And so he deals with communal affairs of his own community and communities from around the world all the way from after prayers on Shabbat. He obviously has some meal, but the rest of the day is engaged in the needs of the community. He says, when can I see you? So that's a personal letter. He writes in another letter, a lot of interesting personal letters, one about the death of his older brother. His older brother, David, supported him. His older brother was apparently a diamond and precious gem merchant. And he supported the Rambam for most of the early part of his life. David was in a ship that sunk, and his fortune sunk with it. David died. Maimonides writes about him, he was my friend, he was my beloved, he was my brother, he was my teacher, he was my student, he was my colleague. He says, anytime I see something that he had in his possession, he says, I collapse in tears. He says he was in a deep depression for over a year after the death of his brother to the point of physical sickness. He could barely get out of his bed. He said, in addition to which, he said, now the burden of supporting his own family plus his brother's family also fell upon him. And he now had to take up the practice of medicine, and he had to support two families now. So very interesting, a lot of personal insight of Maimonides, of the Rambam, in many, many of his letters. He's got letters of rebuke, a man who left his wife to go and learn, and he writes a strong letter of rebuke. How could you do such a thing, etc.? It's actually in poetry, interestingly enough. A lot of the early sages used to write letters in poetic form, it's called Derech Militza, using verses from the Torah, the style of verses in the Torah, prophets and writings, to express what they were trying to say. So there is a section of the letters to individuals of what I call personal matters, financial and emotional, etc. There's also a letter of section of the personal letters which were written to answer a lot of questions, but not necessarily halakhic questions, but questions which were more of a philosophical nature. People would ask him all types of stuff. He was the expert, and people would ask him a lot of questions. There are also medical questions there. He has a long question of debate about the purpose of eyebrows with someone else who claimed that they were a mistake. There's a whole lot of interesting letters that he writes there. Most of his letters written in Arabic. I chose, for our selection today, two letters. There's actually two out of three. There's a section of three letters which were written to a person called Ovadia Hager. Ovadia is his name. Ger, he is a convert to Judaism. Ovadia was an Arab, a Muslim Arab, who had converted to Judaism at the time of the Rambam, which is not, as you could guess, in the peaceful, peace-loving, tolerant Islamic societies of today, is enough to get someone, for example, in Afghanistan, a death sentence for converting to Christianity. This is after, by the way, just for those who are not familiar with current events, this is after the United States has already installed a wonderful new government in Afghanistan. That wonderful new government in Afghanistan sentenced someone to death But of course it was commuted in the end because of massive international pressure, and the guy was given safe haven in Italy for the crime of converting to Christianity. So let's go, that's in the 21st century, with a government which is an ally of the United States. Let's go back to the 1200s, right, and you can imagine what it was like for an Arab Muslim to have converted to Judaism. So Obadiah was a special person, right? So the courage and the heroism of someone like that is absolutely unbelievable. And so he wrote, and it doesn't sound like he was a great scholar, but he wrote three questions to the Rambam. And I've got two of them here. If we have time, maybe we'll get to the third one as well. And it's interesting, of almost all the questions, all the answers and letters that Maimonides writes, almost 99% of them are in Arabic, which was his native language and was the native language of something like 80 to 90% of the Jews at the time. So it's clear he'd write in Arabic, with the exception of the letters he writes to Obadiah the convert. He writes them initially in Hebrew. Why do you think he does that? In my opinion, he is displaying extraordinary sensitivity. Here is an Arab, a Muslim, who converts to Judaism. To write to him in Arabic, as he would to anyone else, right, maybe Obadiah would feel some level of being slighted in some... Arabic, he talks to me in Arabic. Maimonides specifically addresses him in our language, in Hebrew, the true Mama Loshen, right? He addresses him in Hebrew because he wants to say, you're one of us, right? I think that's a very beautiful thing that he just writes that in Hebrew. Just by the way, a word about translation. This is my open free translation of the Hebrew. The other letters, since they're in Arabic, there's been quite a few different translations of the letters. I guess the most, well, there's a few. There's one by Yehuda Blau of Hebrew University, and there's another one by Yosef Kappa, who's a famous Yemenite scholar, translated a lot of Maimonides' stuff from Arabic into modern Hebrew, and more recently Yitzhak Shilat of Mar Lao Zumin produced a translation. In any case, I'm using the manuscript of Rav Yitzhak Shilat, which I think is probably the best manuscript for this translation, and I'd like to read through with you and explain a little bit about what Maimonides writes to Obadiah the convert. So the question he asks is, regarding the prayers and blessings, regarding the prayers and blessings, whether in private or public, should you say, this is what Obadiah is asking, should I say, our God and God of our fathers, that you have sanctified us in your commandments, asher hivdilanu, that you have separated us from the nations. By the way, asher hivdilanu does not appear in our version of the Siddur anywhere. This probably is from the Rambam's version of the Siddur, which is in Uvalat Tzion Goel. Towards the end, we say Baruch Hu Elokeinu Shebarah Lanu Kol Tovim, hivdilanu min hagoyim, hivdilanu min hatoim, separate us from those who make a mistake. I think the Rambam's nusach is probably asher hivdilanu. So that's where he writes it. But asher bachavanu, you chose us. Shein chalkel avotenu, you inherited to our fathers the land of Israel. Shotetanu, Eretz Yisrael, you took us out of Egypt. Shasanisim lavotenu, you did miracles for our forefathers. Obviously, Obadiah is bothered by this. Is he saying something which is inaccurate? When he stands there as he's a Muslim. He was a Muslim. He was an Arab, right? He stands there and says, our fathers, our forefathers, what do you mean? He says, my forefathers weren't in Egypt. Of course, you know, you could actually bring proof from the Haggadah. The Rambam doesn't do that. But in the Haggadah, we say the proof that you have to be Marveh, exceed, and do a lot of discussion of Sifri Yetzias Mitzrayim, of the Exodus from Egypt, is brought from the four rabbis who were in Bnei Barak. Of those rabbis, two of them were Levites, which means, were their ancestors slaves? The Levites weren't slaves in Egypt. Rabbi Akiva was Ben Gerim. He was the son of converts, which means his ancestors were not in Egypt either, right? And all of them, right, were the greatest sages of Israel, which means they knew it all, been there, done that. And despite that, they all spoke about it all night. That's the depth of the proof, because the proof is like, I mean, they knew it all. And for them, personally, it wasn't even something, so, but Maimonides doesn't discuss that. But he does bring other proofs. But again, the gist of the question is, can a convert honestly say, Shinchalta la'avoteinu, you gave to our ancestors the land of Israel. My parents who were in Egypt, my father Abraham, my father Isaac and Jacob. How can he say this thing? Okay, that's his question. I think the question is pretty clear. Right. See, so Maimonides answers the following. Yeshacha, first of all, he says, Higiu, I didn't read the introduction, which I don't know if I... Yes, the introduction. Higiu elai shelot marana v'rabana ovadia. These are the questions that I received from marana v'rabana. Marana v'rabana means... Mar means master, Rabbana means our teacher. He gives him the title, our master and teacher, Ovadia. Now clearly from the questions, Ovadia was not a great scholar, but nevertheless Maimonides addresses him with tremendous respect. We know that the Torah tells us in something like, I think it's at least 7 or 8 places, right, not to oppress the convert. Right, to treat the stranger and the convert with sensitivity. And Maimonides calls him Marana v'Rabbana. Hamaskil hamevin, the one who understands and perceives, the Ger Tzedek, Yishalem Hashem Polo, may Hashem pay his wages, the Tamis Karatos Shlemamim Hashem Elokei Yisrael. This, by the way, is the blessing that Boaz gave to Ruth. Ruth was the prototypical, ultimate convert to Judaism. Many laws of conversion we learn from Ruth. Ruth was such a great convert. I mean, her grandson was a great grandson was King David, right? The Davidic lineage, the Messiah, comes from Ruth. So if he's giving Ovadia the blessing that was given by Boaz to Ruth, what he's saying is, you are like Ruth. So from beginning to end, you can feel the love that Maimonides have for him. And it's interesting, I should just point out parenthetically, Rav Yitzhak Huttner says in Tachad Yitzhak on Pesach, a halachic idea, he says that, let's say you don't know, you've got a neighbor who's Jewish, you have no idea he's Jewish, but you like the guy. Not only, you love this person, he's a wonderful guy, you love him, but you don't know he's Jewish. Have you fulfilled the mitzvah of the Ahavta L'Re'acha Kamocha, love your fellow Jew? Have you fulfilled that mitzvah? Rav Huttner says no. He says the idea of love for the fellow Jew is to love him because he is Jewish. He says the same is true. It says, Ve'ahavtem et hager. Love this convert. Love the convert. Why do you have to love the convert? He says, you only fulfill the mitzvah, the obligation of loving the convert, if you love him because he's a convert. I love this person because he came to rest under the wings of the divine presence. So, and you can feel that from the letter of Maimonides. You can clearly feel his love for this convert, right? Because he came to Judaism. So Maimonides answers the following answer. He says, you should say everything ketikunan as it's written. Al tishane davar, don't change anything. Ela kmoshi palel v'yivarech kol ezach Yisrael, as every single Jewish citizen prays and makes blessings, so it is appropriate for you to bless and pray in the same way. Whether you are alone, whether you are leading a congregation as a chazan, he says the essence of the idea is that Abraham was our father. He taught people, and he taught them about Judaism. He taught them the way of truth, and he taught them about the unity of God. He said he rejected idol worship, and he has denied its service. We all know, Maimonides says, in the beginning of the laws of idol worship, beginning of the laws of Avodah Zorah, that Abraham Avinu, who from the time he was born in a society that was deeply, deeply embedded in idol worship. His father, according to the Midrash, manufactured idols, idols are us, or whatever it was, and he manufactured them. And Abraham Avinu, right, until he was much older, the question of what age precisely, but he worshipped with them. But he was always questioning it. He started to even question it from the time he was a child. From the age of 3, it already bothered him. How it could be, in the words of Isaiah, you could take a piece of wood, use one half for the barbecue, and say that the other half created the world. Right? So a precocious 3-year-old can probably figure out that there's something bizarre about this. Right? And he did. And he broke down idols. And he was someone who was clearly led people towards God. The Hichnis Rabim Tachat Kanfei Hashkina, he brought many people under the wings of the divine presence. The verse says, HaNefesh, it says that when Abraham and Sarah came towards Canaan, it says they brought with them HaNefesh Asher Asu B'Charan, the souls that they'd made in Haran. And the Zohar, I think it is, that says this, actually it's the Medrash, it says, if all of humanity, every single scientist, every person got together, they could not create a living being. Could not create life. How can it say that Abraham and Sarah made souls, created souls in Haran? And the answer is that these are the people they brought into monotheism, they brought to God. And those are people that it was though they made them, they created them. So he says, therefore Abraham did this. Abraham and Sarah taught these people. He commanded his children and his children's children to guard the way of Hashem, as it says in the Torah. I loved him. In order, because he commanded his children to guard the way of God. He says, therefore, anyone who converts until the end of all generations, he says, and anyone who accepts upon himself the unity of the name of God, as it's written in the Torah, is a student of Abraham and a member of his household. And all of them, it was Abraham who brought back to God. Meaning, he says, you, Ovadia, who convert to Judaism in the 12th century or 13th century, whoever it was, 13th century, he says, you have been converted to Judaism by Abraham. It was Abraham who brought you close. Not personally. Kishem Shehichvir Anshei Dorah, as he brought close people of his generation through himself and his own efforts, he brought you close through his descendants. In other words, we are agents of Abraham. We're the Shluchim. Right, to use a modern day terminology, right? We're Shlichim, right? We are the messengers of Abraham, and Abraham brought people close to God, so he sent us forth, his children and grandchildren, to do exactly the same thing. He says to Avadi, you should consider yourself as a student and a member of the household of Abraham Avinu. V'heim kol ger shenikayeh. He says, He says, so therefore Abraham is a father to his children, his sherim, his kosher children that follow him, and he is the father to his students, and that means all people who will convert to Judaism sincerely. And he says, so Abraham ultimately is, and that's actually in the name of Abraham, his name was changed from Avram, which was interpreted as the father of Aram, to Abraham, Av Hamon Goyim, the father of many nations. Father of many nations means he's literally looked at as the father of someone who converts and enters into Judaism. When you think about it, well, he'll talk about it further on. But he says, and therefore you can say our God and the God of our fathers, because Abraham is your father. And therefore you can say that you gave to our fathers the land of Israel, because to Abraham the land was given. And he says, and you can say that you took, he says the following. However, regarding you took us out of Egypt, or that you did miracles for our forefathers, he says, if you want to change that and say you took the Jews out of Egypt, he says, and you did miracles for the Jews, you can do that. He says, in other words, he wanted to say, look, if you don't feel comfortable saying took our forefathers out of Egypt, right, he says, fine. You can feel comfortable saying that. But I want to tell you, he says, in Loshinitaklum, if you didn't change anything, you said your prayers exactly as every other Jew does, he says, Ein Bekat Hesed, there's nothing wrong with that. Because once you have entered under the wings of the Divine Presence and accompanied God on this journey, there is no difference between you and us. All the miracles that were done, as though they were done for you and for us together. He says, it says in Isaiah, that the stranger should not say, God has separated me from his people. He says, there's no difference whatsoever between you and us. And he says, you could say that God, you chose us from all nations and gave us the Torah and separated us from those who make a mistake. He says, because certainly God chose you. God has helped separate you from those who make a mistake. He said, God gave you the Torah, because the Torah was given to us and to the converts, and that's explicit. It says in the pasuk, Hakal chuka achat lachem lager hagar chukat olam dorotechem kachem kager yelus nashem. There is one statute for you, the native-born Israelite, and for the stranger amongst who dwells amongst you, i.e. the convert. Torah achat u'mishpat achat yelachem. Everyone has the same law. He says, therefore, you can say all these things. And then we come to, I think, which is one of the most beautiful paragraphs, and I think also a very basic idea. The Rambam now says, you should know that our forefathers who came out of Egypt, most of them were also pagans. He says the Jews that came out of Egypt worshipped idols when they were in Egypt. We know that the Midrash says the Jews kept their Jewish identity how?
Their name, language,
clothing. Right? They didn't intermarry. But basically, now if that's what you can say about them, what does that mean about their philosophy? Maimonides says in his introduction to the laws of idol worship, he said the flame of monotheism that Abraham lit was almost extinguished in Egypt. The Jews were embedded in Egyptian ideology, in Egyptian superstition, in Egyptian idol worship. The very famous Midrash that says when the Jews are going through the Dead Sea, the angel said, hey, they said, how could, what, right, they said, you're drowning these people and you're saving these people. Halalu oithe avodah zarah. Halalu oithe avodah zarah. They're both idol worshippers. So Maimonides is pointing out to him, he says, if you are embarrassed about your ancestry, think about ours. Right? He says, because our ancestors, many of them were idol worshippers. He says, and in Egypt, he says, Nit'arvu bagoyim, they mixed amongst the nations of the Egyptians. V'lamdu v'maaseihem, they learnt from their actions. Until God sent Moses to take out the Jews, the father of all prophets, to take us out of Egypt, to separate us from the nation, and to bring us together under the wings of the divine presence. This is an important idea. It's interesting, in Halakha, where do we learn the laws of conversion from? Now, keep in mind, we don't learn them from Rus. We learn some ideas from Rus, but you cannot derive them from Rus, because Rus is one of the books of the prophets and the writings. So where do we derive them from in the Torah itself? Where is conversion in the Torah itself? Har Sinai, Mount Sinai. When the Jews came to Mount Sinai, we were not Jewish. I hate to break this to you. Right? But technically speaking, we weren't Jewish. What's Jewish? Jewish is defined by the Torah. Was the Torah given yet?
No.
If the Torah wasn't given yet, there was no legal code that defined what Jewish. That's why the question I often get from people, which is silly when you think about it, is, well, what do you mean? Intermarriage must be fine. I say, oh really? Why is that? They say, well, because Abraham married Sarah, who was from wherever, right? Aram, right? And Moses married Zipporah, who was Ethiopian, right? And Joseph married Othnah but Potipharah, who was Egyptian, so that was okay. The answer to this is all very simple. Right? Before the Torah was given, there were no laws about this. If someone became a monotheist, you could marry them. If they're a polytheist, you could not marry them. If they're idolatrous, stay away from them. If they've accepted the monotheistic laws, you can marry them. There was no law about it. I tell people, well, Abraham was allowed to marry her because he wasn't Jewish. At the time, neither was Moses. Right? This is when they get really upset with me. Right? And so, what's we do? But you see, technically speaking, it's true. Because from a technical perspective, Jewish law only begins with Mount Sinai. There were Jews who had promises. They were not classic converts. Because most converts, there's nothing that says you have to convert. Because there's no promise to your ancestors, as you know, who say you're going to have to go to this shul at this point and convert to Judaism. With the Jews, there was. The Jews, there was a prior history, right? God had promised our ancestors that he would bring us to Mount Sinai and we would have the covenant with God. However, the fact is that when we came to Mount Sinai, that was the ultimate act of conversion. And if you look at Maimonides in the Laws of Prohibited Relationships, where he talks about conversions, chapter 14 there, he says the following. He says that all the laws of conversion are basically a repetition of Mount Sinai. A person wants to become Jewish, there's only one way of becoming Jewish. Either your soul had to be at Mount Sinai, or you have got to go to mini Mount Sinai. That's not the theme park near Tel Aviv. But the mini Mount Sinai I refer to here is that you have to go through a Mount Sinai experience. Meaning, there has to be bris milah, there has to be immersion in the mikvah. The Jews had bris milah. And all the Jews purified themselves at Mount Sinai. And not only that, and what did they do? They all said two famous words, Naaseh v'nishma, we will do and we will obey. In other words, there was an unconditional acceptance of all the mitzvahs, both those that they knew and those that they did not know. That's exactly what everyone who converts does, the same thing. And in the same way as Mount Sinai was conducted via the presence of Moshe, who Omed bein Hashem bein Eichem. Moses says, I stood between God and you. So for all generations, the representatives of Moshe, i.e. a duly appointed Jewish court, are also present for all parts of the conversion. So what the Rambam is doing here is he's saying, don't feel that you are different or inferior. Don't feel that because you've come to Judaism later in history, you're any less. He says, our ancestors, he says, were idol worshippers in Egypt. Until God sent Moses and brought them out and brought them to Mount Sinai and converted them like you converted. And then he goes on to say, and this is, I think, the most beautiful line in the whole letter. I'll read it in Hebrew because it's just very beautiful. He said, Al yihi yichuscha kal be'enecha. Don't let your yichus, your genealogy, be light in your eyes. Im anu mityachasim el Avram Yitzhak v'Yaakov, although we can trace ourselves back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, ata mityaches l'misha amar v'haya ha'olam, your yichus can be traced back to he who spoke and created the world. He says, don't think you've got a bad yichus. He says, we can walk around saying, oh yeah, my Zayda was Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. And you can say, my Zayda is a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Right, which is better? So that's what the Rambam says. He says, Aliyah Yichusa Kal Ben Echad. Don't let your Yichus, right, be great, be light and nothing in your eyes, because you can trace yourself back to Hashem. We trace ourselves back Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. And, of course, in truth, we all trace ourselves back to our Kodesh Baruch Hu. He says, but if someone is being mitpa'er, mitga'er, someone is being haughty, arrogant, and proud of their back to Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov, he says, you can be proud of going back to the one who spoke and created the world. And he quotes the verse, which is a very beautiful verse. I think it was the Haftorah a couple of weeks ago. V'chein meforesh b'Yeshaya, ze yomar la'ashem ani, v'ze yikra b'shem Yaakov. One will say, I belong to God. And the other will be called by the name Jacob. So Maimonides interprets it in the following way. Hager Yomar, the convert will say, L'Hashem Ani, I belong to God. Va'Yisraeli, and the native-born Jew, Yikare, B'Shem Yaakov, will trace himself back to Jacob. So, and you do, people play the Yichus game often, you know what I mean? You ever heard, I'm sure you've heard it all the time, right? You know, oh yes, so who's your grandfather, or who's your, what rebbe are you from, etc., you know, that type of stuff. And the Rambam is saying, let's take it easy here, right? He says, we can all trace ourselves back to Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, and the Ger can trace himself back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the bulk, or the body of the letter, in which he tells him what he should do in practice. He says, you can say Abraham was your father, that's 100% absolutely correct. You can say Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that you got the land of Israel, your fathers were given the land of Israel, because you are a child and a student and a member of the house of Abraham by the fact that you converted to Judaism. If by yourself you are praying privately and you feel uncomfortable and you'd like to say that you did miracles to my fathers, for example, Hanukkah, he might feel a little weird. You did miracles to my fathers in the times of the Maccabees, is, you know, he makes a wit. He says, you're okay not to say that. But he says, ultimately, if you don't change anything in any of the prayers, it's 100% fine. 100% fine. Okay, then he brings a proof. And his proof is from a Mishnah, which talks about Bikurim. When you bring the first fruits to the land, to the temple in the at Shavuos, as we will hopefully do this Shavuos, you bring the first fruits to the Beis Hamikdash, if you get a farm in enough time, right? And if you bring the first fruits to the Beis Hamikdash, you must say what's called vidui. You must say a declaration, and the declaration involves a long statement about, which actually is the Haggadah, is built around, much of the Haggadah is built around that statement, and we talk about what happened to our ancestors. So the Mishnah says a convert does not say that. Now this would appear not to be a good proof for what Maimonides is saying, right? But he says, wrong, he says, because that Mishnah is the view of an individual. He says that the halacha is not like that Mishnah, which goes according to Rav Meir. The halacha goes in accordance, in the Yerushalmi, it says that the halacha goes like Rav Meir, Rav Yehuda says, ger mevi atzma mevi v'korah, the ger, a convert, brings first fruits to the temple and says exactly the same as every other Jew. Right? Why? Because he says, ki av hamon goyim esaticha, I made you the father of many nations, etc. And by the way, So I'm going to end that letter here, because that is actually the gist of the letter, and that is the proof that he brings. He ends it by saying, don't change anything in any of the blessings. Just by the way, this letter is quoted by the Mishnah Berurah, by the Chafetz Chaim in his Mishnah Berurah, in Orech Chaim Nun Gimel. There, the Ramah quotes someone who says that there are those who don't want to let a convert lead prayers and be the chazan, because they felt uncomfortable with the convert saying, "Our Father, our fathers, Elokeinu v'Elokei Avos, God of our fathers." And however, he says this view is totally rejected. And Mishnah Berurah says, why is this view rejected? Why do we accept that a convert leads the congregation and says, "Our fathers," even though technically they're not? He says the answer is because technically they are. He says, the Mishnah Berurah says, because Av Hamon Goyim Asaticha, and he quotes this letter of the Rambam in the Mishnah Berurah. Yes. Does he deal with that? Yes. He actually says, if you look he says, Orech Chaim Mem Vav, the Ramah says, they discuss whether he can actually say that. There's actually a machlokas achroimim, there's an argument amongst the later scholars whether he can actually say that statement. If I remember correctly, the Mishnah Berurah paskens, Mishnah Berurah rules that he may say that, but it's a matter of argument amongst the poskim. But everyone agrees that he can say all the rest of the brachas plain, and the source for this ruling is ultimately this letter of the Rambam. So that is letter number one. Letter number two is actually quite controversial. In letter number two, this is the question. It doesn't, the question we don't have, but basically, all we have of the question is the following, which is that Ovadia said to him, explain to me the statement of everything is in the hands of heaven except for the fear of heaven. Now, it's a very famous statement. Rav Chanina said to Gemara in Brachos, Amar Rav Chanina, Hakol Bidei Shamayim, Chutz Meyirat Shamayim, everything is in the hands of heaven except for the fear of heaven. Now apparently, Ovadia's rabbi had explained it in one way, and Ovadia's asking the Rambam if his rabbi is right. There's actually a third letter, which we're not going to get to, but let me just tell you the gist of it, because it's really cool. The third letter, Ovadia is at a class given by his local Orthodox rabbi, I assume, right? And the rabbi was saying that Islam is idol worship. So Ovadia says, Ovadia says, look, I was a Muslim for like 25 years. I've read the Quran, I know the Hadith, I've said the prayers. It's not idolatry, right? Muslims worship one God, right? It's not idolatry. So the rabbi said, you're an idiot. He yelled at him, right? He said, you're a fool. He says, they're idolaters. You don't know what you're talking about. I got very angry at him. So Ovadia wrote to the Rambam, it's the third letter, right? And he wrote to the Rambam, and he said, what do you say? So the Rambam writes back to him. He says, hey, even if your rabbi was right and you were wrong, it was wrong for him to be angry and yell at you and insult you publicly. So he owes you an apology. How much more so, he said, since you are right and he's wrong? He says, because the Muslims are not idol worshippers, and you are right. He says, thirdly, if you have come, according to his idea, mistaken idea, from idolatry to monotheism, how can he call you a fool? You are the most intelligent of people, even according to the rabbi, because you've come from idolatry to monotheism. He said, fourth, the Torah exhorts us not to oppress the gentle, not to oppress the convert, not to be harsh to the stranger. He says, so your rabbi has transgressed over 15 biblical prohibitions by speaking harshly unto you. And he says, and number five, the Talmud says, one who loses his temper should be in your eyes as though he's worshipped idols. So not only are the Muslims not idol worshippers, but your rabbi is. It's a little heavy. You know, you can imagine, you can frame that next to your smicha. Look, I got a letter from the Rambam. He says, I'm an idolater, but that's not important. Right, so, okay. So, evidently, his rabbi, I don't know who the local rabbi was, right, but his local rabbi, whatever it was, Young Israel of Fez, or whatever it was, right, his local rabbi evidently also explained that the statement of everything is in the hands of heaven, except for the fear of heaven, he had expanded that to a degree that was very minimizing of the idea of free will. And that's what Maimonides is going, the Rambam is going to address. So he says the following.
says the following. That which you stated, that all human actions are not a result of God's decree, is true without any doubt. In other words, Obadiah intuitively felt that his rabbi was wrong here. I don't know if he stayed in this shul or not, you know what I mean? I'm not, frankly, I would have left, but okay, right? He says, your statement that all human actions are not a result of God's decree is without any doubt correct. And because of this, one's rewarded for doing good and punished for doing evil. Obviously, if your actions were the decree of God, how could you be punished? How could you be rewarded? How could there be commandments? He says, and Maimonides says, and all human actions are included under the fear of God. Because the end result of everything that a person does is either a commandment or a sin. This is pretty amazing. The Rambam says, and he elaborates on this in his introduction to Ethics of the Fathers, and Shmona Prakim and things in 6 and 7. The Rambam says the following, that really, virtually anything you do, obviously we're talking about voluntary actions, whether thought is included under that is questionable. The Rambam, it seems to say that if you get a bad thought or something like that, you're not punished for that because it's not really in control. He says, but carrying it out, doing an action, making a decision, and doing something right or wrong, one way or the other, he says, is clearly your free will. And he says, even things which you don't consider normally mitzvah and azera, even things that you would not normally look at that way. I actually have here the interesting, he says, I'll just quote you what he says in the Shmona Prakim, the 8 chapters. He says, there's the involuntary reflexes of a human being and the area of the imagination, neither of those are under your complete control. So under those areas, the involuntary actions, reflex, breathing, things like that, not totally under your control, and also imagination, like thoughts pop into your head, so it's not always under your control. He says, however, right, when he says all human actions, he says there is confusion about this, and he believes the intellect is under our free will control in matters of true and false belief, and all of our actions, right, are included under that. Why? He says, because Maimonides says, every activity can either be a mitzvah or an avera. Anything can be a sin, anything can be a mitzvah. The Chovas HaBavos says a similar idea. He says, all actions of a human that fall under the category of permitted are really either mitzvahs or averas. Because anything that's not absolutely necessary for your physical and psychological and spiritual survival is a sin. And if you are doing it because it's necessary for your psychological, physical, spiritual survival, then it's a mitzvah. So therefore, when it says, Hakol bidei shamayim, everything's in the hands of heaven, except for the fear of heaven, right, everything is does not mean your actions, means everything else. The weather, right, other people's actions and how they'll impact you, etc. But your actions and your decisions in every area of life, he says, because they ultimately will lead to mitzvah or avera, are really under your commandment, under your free will. He says, and that which the sages said everything is in the hands of heaven, that refers to the functioning of the world. Its origins, its nature, like trees, animals, living beings, intellects, the heavenly spheres, the angels, they're all in the hands of heaven. He says, and I've already discussed this at great length in my commentary to Ethics of the Fathers. He says, so he says really everything like that is part of what we call Hakol Biyadei Shamayim Chutz Meyirat Shamayim. Yirat Shamayim doesn't just mean shall I govern or not, shall I eat the pork or not. He says Yirat Shamayim includes every decision we make. Every decision we make. Shall I go here for vacation or not? Shall I eat this or not? It's both being kosher. Right? Shall I drink this or not? Both being kosher. So on and so forth, that's all under Yirat Shamayim. Because anything that's got to do with your moral, ethical, spiritual life is pretty much anything you do. He says, that's all bidei avan, all in the hands of human beings. He says, now, I know you're bothered. Because you're bothered, he says, because if you put aside this idea, first of all, he says, anyone who puts aside this idea, which are based on the very foundations of all of creation, and chooses a statement here or there in the Medrash, a statement here or there in the sages, or even a verse in the prophets that seems to contradict this, he says, is doing the wrong thing. Such a person is committing suicide. And what he's done to his own soul is sufficient punishment for it. Let's read you what he says. He says, anyone who puts aside this idea and believes that his actions are not under his own control, such a person is committing suicide. This is what he says. Eina eila me'abed atzmo ladat. He is committing suicide intentionally. V'daylo mashiyase benafsho. It's sufficient punishment what he's doing to himself. Because if he denies his own, the significance of his own actions, why is he here? He's basically said that he is nothing, he's insignificant, he's a lab rat. He's running around the Skinner maze, he's getting occasional stimuli one way or the other, he's getting the food pellets or the bipolar electroconvulsive therapy, and that's it. Right? And he's, you know, what's the use of being alive? I mean, I think if a person has a deterministic view of the world, what can you accomplish? There's no failure, there's no success, there's nothing. All you are is you're a nothing. Absolutely nothing. Not in the Musa sense, right? I used to be a Gurnish type thing, right? But a person really is a nothing. They really are a nothing. Because their actions have no impact, no significance, no responsibility, no reward, no punishment. So that's what the Rambam says. And then he says, I know. Your rabbi said to you, quoted to you a statement in the Gemara. The statement in the Gemara, I'm sure everyone knows this, it's a Gemara in Sota 2a, which says that 40 days before the conception of a child, a bas kol, a voice from heaven comes out and says, bas ploini leploini, the daughter of so-and-so will marry so-and-so. I'm sure everyone's heard that. Right? That, I mean, not that you've heard the voice from heaven, right? Oh, you may have. If you're married, you probably have heard the voice from heaven, right? So, but again, you certainly have heard of this Gemara. And doesn't this seem to contradict what Maimonides says? Because what is marriage? Would you say that the decision of marriage is a decision that would fall under Yirat Shamayim? Of course, God. Right? I mean, imagine, like, depending on who you marry, right, whom you marry, will change your entire free will for the rest of your life. Right? It will change your entire, right, if you're the man, it removes it completely, right? But I'm saying, it will change, though, your point of struggle is completely different. Whom you marry, I mean, the Torah tells us I'm not allowed to marry certain people. If it's predetermined and predestined who I will marry, then it's obviously ridiculous to have commandments about who to marry and who not to marry. It's only possible to give me a command of whether I can, and punish me for marrying the wrong person, a kohen to a grusha, a Jew to a non-Jew, right, a kohen gadol to a, I mean, so on and so forth. I mean, is it, or mamzer to someone who's not a mamzer, and so on and so forth. Right, and clearly, marriage is part of what we call yirat shamayim. When we say hakol bidei shamayim chutz mi yirat shamayim, except for the fear of heaven, that means the decision about whom to marry is in whose hands? Yeah. Huh? Whose hands then? Everything is in the hands of heaven except for the fear of heaven. The decision about whom to marry is therefore in whose hands? No! Obviously, you do not make... No. Logic 101. Right? We just define that the decision of who to marry is clearly called Yirat Shamayim, right? Step by step, folks. The decision of whom to marry, is that Yirat Shamayim? Of course, nothing. Right? The statement in the Talmud says everything's in the hands of heaven except for Yirat Shamayim. Don't make me draw a Venn diagram, please. Okay. Right? That means if the decision of to marry is Yirat Shamayim, then the statement of the Gemara that says everything's in the hands of heaven except for the fear of heaven means that marriage is not in the hands of heaven, it's in your hands. QED, quaderat demonstrandum, quite easily done. Right? That is so. The Rambam would seem to be saying that the whole idea that it is predestined whom you will marry is not true. So he says, and he goes on to say, okay, he says, that which your rabbi said to you, the daughter of Ploni is to Ploni, if he understands this is an absolute decree, that it's inevitable that you will marry A, B, or C. He says, and this statement should be understood at face value, he says, why does it say in the Torah that a man who's betrothed to a woman should not go to war before the wedding? Why not? Because the Torah says, lest he die in war and another man marry her. And now, according to the statement of Gemara, you say, so what? If he's supposed to die in war and the other man's supposed to marry her, that was the predestined match. Why should that be a bother? Why should it bother us? Lest he die in the war and another man partake of his vineyard. Hello, wasn't it decreed 40 days before he was even conceived that the other man will partake of that vineyard? So what that means, the Rambam says, is that the Torah itself tells us clearly that it wasn't predestined. It was a matter of your bechira, of your free will. Which puts a little bit of a a splinter in the idea of Beshert, doesn't it? Right? I mean, and I think it's pretty clear. So what does the Rambam do with the Gemara in Soita? What does the Rambam do with the statement that says 40 days before? Right? Because clearly the Torah itself says differently. You can't get better authority than Chumash, generally, I find that. Right? Better than Chumash, right, pretty clear. Torah says, don't go out to war, lest he die in war, someone else marry this woman. What do you mean someone else? You mean the person that was decreed 40 days before? So that's fine. Shouldn't be a risk. So, how does the Rambam deal with it? So he says the following. He says, that which the sages said, beforehand, he gives a little introduction, he says, something which is clear in the Torah, a clear foundation of our belief. Hashem is one. Hashem is not corporeal. Hashem is eternal. So on and so forth. He says, you have a clear foundation of belief. We have free will, so on and so forth. And you find a verse somewhere, or a statement of the sages somewhere that seems to contradict that. He says, you know what you have to say to yourself? Try and figure out how it fits in with what the Chumash clearly says. If you can figure it out, great. If not, then you should say, I don't understand the full depth of this verse. I don't understand the full depth of this prophet. I don't understand the full depth of this sage. Dvarim shebegavan yeshkan. There are things which are deep and hidden here. I don't understand them. Person should have the humility, but he should also have, you know, we've got these principles of faith. This is a principle of faith, free will. Alright, free will is central. He says, I find a verse that seems to contradict that. What should I either try to resolve it? And if I cannot resolve it, then what do I have to do? I have to sit back and say, ich weiß nicht. Not that the Rambam would have said that, whatever is in Arabic, right? Allah al-Atakad, whatever, right? So, then that's fine. That's what you should do. And then he goes on to say, so how do I explain the statement in the Gemara of Saita? Statement that says 40 days before, he says the following. He says, it's reward or punishment. If the man or woman performed a mitzvah for which they deserve reward is a wonderful and praiseworthy match, then God arranges the match. If they deserve a match in which they'll be fighting and arguments continuously, he'll arrange that too. Actually, I know Shulchan's like that. Right? As the sages state, even one mamzer in one end of the world, and one mamzer, a mamzer is an offspring of incest or adultery. And they can only marry another mamzer or mamzeret. So if there's one mamzer in one end of the world, another mamzeret in the other end of the world, it says the following, the Holy One, blessed be He, will bring them together and make the match. The Rambam says the following. His understanding of the moral is like this. You might have merit, and the merit is that you deserve a great shidduch. You deserve a great person, a wonderful, wonderful person, right? So now, what will HaKadosh Baruch Hu do? He will make sure you meet that person. He will make sure you meet that person. Of course, a person might be a lowlife and deserve to have the worst, right? To have someone who's just, right, whether it's man or a woman, they deserve it. They deserve each other. You know, that's like, who was it? I think it was George Bernard Shaw was at a wedding of two people who he intensely disliked, which wouldn't be hard to find. And he once said, he says, the most happy thing about this wedding is that they married each other and they didn't both marry other people. He says, this way, he says, they contain the misery between these two. Now, that was his view of it, right? So, yes. Right, what he's saying is true, right, that it may be. So in other words, yeah, if it's something like that, a Kodesh Baruch Hu will make sure it doesn't matter where you live, doesn't matter who you know, you'll end up meeting this person for whom you have tzus. So yes, if you doesn't, and if you have tzus, and if you do mitzvahs, right, then yes, you'll meet your Beshet. Now, I should point out a caveat here. He'll let you meet, but will he force you to make the decision? I don't think so. He'll put you in the same hotel lobby, right, or whatever it is, right, wherever they do in the United States, the same airport, I don't know, whatever, and you will, they don't do that anymore, I don't know where people go on dates in the States, but Hashem will make sure. My wife is from Philadelphia, I'm from Australia. I'm from Melbourne, Australia, she's from Philadelphia. We're both in Israel, right, at different schools, obviously, right, I was at a yeshiva, which was not co-ed, right, and she was at school. Now, you know, I heard just a friend of mine, Rabbi Jeff Wogelanter from San Diego. He and his wife were running a program in Sydney, Australia, an outreach program. So I said to my Rebbe, Rabbi Shapiro, I said, look, I hear that Jeff Wogelanter is running this program in Australia. Do you think I should go? He said, tell me about the program. I said, I'll have to take approximately 2.5 months off learning. I'll be there running a mixed sleepaway camp for non-religious Australian teenagers aged 14 to 16. I'll be working with four unmarried women from the Ve'i Yerushalayim, and that's basically what's going to happen. So Rabbi Shapiro thinks about it and he says, Atam chuyav lalechet. You're obligated to go. I said, whoa, cool. So I didn't say that at the time. I said, why? I was like pretty shocked. He said, A, you'll get to see your parents, which you otherwise wouldn't be able to do at this point. He says, B, you'll give something back to the Australian community from which you came from. C, it'll be valuable teaching experience for you. It was actually my first peer of experience. And he says, C, there's an obligation to bring people close to Torah, do Kiruv. And he says, D, five, he said, five, you never know what good will come out of it. So I said, great. He said, who's running it? I said, Rabbi Revson. So the next morning, Rabbi Shapiro comes over to me in yeshiva with a little note with the phone number of Rabbi Revson. He says, call him. I call Rabbi Revson. I come to his office. He looks at me and he says, Becher, huh? I said, yes. He says, last night I was at the Kosel, the Western Wall. He says, I could not find any men to send to Australia on this program I'm running. I have women coming out of my ears at Nevada. I was looking for one good man. He says, I turn around after Mara, there's Ramosha Shapiro standing there. He walks over to me, he says, I have an Australian boffer who wants to go to Australia to do outreach in your program. I think it'd be very good. He says, my faith in God was renewed. So he hired me for the program. And my wife, who after Bryn Mawr had gone to Shal Hevet at Nevei, she was looking for something to do in the summer, during break, and someone mentioned to her this program in Australia, and she thought, yeah, sounds like a good idea. And so he employed her to go to Australia. Right, and she would stay there for 6 months teaching at a high school there, and during that time Rabbi Revson suggested that maybe we go out, didn't need that much of a suggestion, and we went out and got married, and here we are. Right, so Philadelphia and Melbourne, and we met in Yarramundi, a YMCA camp about 2 hours outside of Sydney, Yarramundi, which is interesting, and one of our first students there was actually Rabbi Jordan's older brother. Type of interesting how things come around like that, right? And in any case, that's what it is. So there's a tzus. You can have a tzus and a person can have the opposite. But the Rama says the idea that it's predestined is not 100%. Now, so Hashem went to great pains, not Kriyas Yamsuf quite, but almost, right, to get us together. But obviously, the final decision, when I said to my hubby, do you want to get married? She says, sure, to whom? We negotiated for a while. She said, okay, you're all right, fine. Right, she was studying abnormal psych at the time, so it probably fitted in with her thesis. So in any case, I wonder always why there's levers around the house. But okay, the decision, however, is yours. So that's the idea. So Besheret is not understood by the Rambam in the way most people understand it. It is not an absolute predestination, right? That's not what Judaism says. Right? Rather, right, if a person has specific tzus, Hashem makes sure they meet. Right? And the Bechira to do it, that comes under what we call Hakol Bidei Shemayim Chutz, Meyira Shemayim, that's Yira Shemayim. Your decision, a person makes the decision, I will marry her, why? Because she's rich. Right? So, I'm not saying it's totally a negative thing, right? I mean, I'll marry her because she's poverty-stricken, ideal, right? Not necessarily, right? I'm saying that if the only reason you're marrying someone is for the money, then you have to think, is that a Yerushalayim decision? There's definitely Yerushalayim plays in that. Not much, but there's stuff, right? There's Yerushalayim there. So that's the idea of the Rambam. And he ends the letter with this idea, and he says, Kol Eilu Advarim, all these words, Benuyim Al Masha Perashu Be'avot, are built in what we spoke about in Ethics of the Fathers, right? Kemosha Hevanta, as you already understood yourself. In other words, he commends him because Avadja already understood these things himself. He says, Kemosha Yishar, he says, the Ein Davar Zeh Shabbat Hakol, but this idea of the destiny of meeting your spouse, etc., he says, not equal for everyone. Eilu Le'elu Shenichayvu or Shazachu, but for those who either have demerit or merit, kamoshi yishar be'enei Elohim, as is upright in the eyes of God. That's the second letter. We did a little bit of the third letter, and that's it for today. Thank you very much. Guten Morgen.